Welcome to the USEA official podcast and a bonus episode for you listeners. A few months ago on the Echo Ratings Eventing podcast, we did a Hall of Fame episode with the double world champion Bruce Davidson celebrating some of the highlights of his career, and we thought that we would share it as it really is a must listen. So sit back, enjoy, and don't forget to subscribe to the USEA official podcast and leave us a review if you would like to do so as well. Thanks for listening. Enjoy. Welcome to the Echo Ratings Eventing Podcast. Welcome to the Echo Ratings Eventing Podcast, and it is another Hall of Fame episode. So we are inducting somebody new into the Hall of Fame. And I'm not going to lie, this is going to be a very, very cool interview to do. Catherine is with me. Catherine, this man has basically done everything in eventing that there is to do.
He has, and he's a hero of heroes. If you talk to some of the people that the modern generation of riders would consider to be heroes, people like Mark Todd, they would name this man as one of their greatest heroes. So it's very cool to be able to talk to him.
Well, we're looking forward to hearing what he has to say and hearing about his career. So let's just get stuck in. Welcome to the Echo Ratings Hall of Fame in the Eventing Podcast, Bruce Davidson.
Thank you very much.
Bruce, you are the only man to win back-to-back world titles. You have no fewer than 10 world and Olympic appearances for the US team to your name, which actually puts you, fun fact, in the top 10 most of riders of any time, which is brilliant. Let's go back to the beginning. Before we get into the real glory days, let's go back to the beginning and the start of your sort of childhood as such. Were you born into a horsey family? Did you always want to ride?
I always wanted to ride. My mother was horsey. I mean, you have to remember her family grew up before the automobile. So yes, everyone had horses to some extent. But I as a child, was very much taken with them. And we lived in the country on a farm. And my family supported me, and my grandparents helped me out. And so, yes, I had got a pony and started riding when I was 4 years old.
Bruce, when did eventing come across your horizons?
I went away to boarding school from the age of 13 to 17. And we had inter-school competitions. I had grown up fox hunting, and I did the pony club and that sort of stuff. But it was probably when I was away in boarding school that I did my first inner school horse trials. But I just mostly wanted to learn how to ride. I didn't care what kind of riding it was. I just wanted to learn how to be the best rider I could.
And in terms of sort of launching into your eventing career as such, from there, I think you weren't very old, were you, when you went to a tryout for the US team? Run by the legendary Jack LeGoff, who actually became a really influential person in your career. Talk us through that, because at that age, you know, you're young, you have the world at your feet. Did you ever think that actually it would become what it did?
Well, no. And again, I have to say, I had people around me that, you know, really kept my feet on the ground, and they made sure that I understand that I wouldn't understand what I didn't know until after my first Olympics. So my first Olympics to me was just going to be an eye-opener to how much more I could do with even the time of a long life. And I think it was always true. I never went out achieving recognition. I just wanted to learn how to ride better.
And tell us about coming to England to train and being based over here for a little bit and starting to compete over here. What were the differences then between eventing in the US and eventing in the UK?
Well, the eventing in the UK at that point, don't forget, we had a 1, 2, 3 and a 4-star, badminton and Burley being the 4-stars. And so in America, if we had 1 3-star each year, it was wonderful. Sometimes it was in the spring, sometimes it was in the autumn. Usually it was in relation to getting the equestrian team ready to compete at whatever was going to happen as far as a Worlds or an Olympics or a Pan American Games. And so the calendar here was nowhere near what it was in England. And I had had some success here and wanted to jump in the deep end. And so in actual fact, when I got married in 1974, we spent our first year in England, both to get away from my in-laws and to get my wife away from her in-laws. And we could both have a year to ourselves, and we took our horses and we did badminton, and then I went ahead and did Burley. And I had a base in England for over 15 years, for, you know, half a year. So for a long time, I went back there, and I had many wonderful connections and friends. And it was all a great experience and a great building experience in my life. And because I had been successful here, I wanted to up the score and go where the competition was harder. And so that's why I traveled there. And I wanted, if my horses were going to do all that work and try that hard, I wanted people to understand how neat they were.
The year that you came over and sort of based yourselves over here, 1974, that was the year that you won your first world title at Burley. And actually, you're still the only person to win back-to-back world titles. Talk us through that, because obviously you're third at badminton in the spring, which is a massive achievement in itself. And then preparations turned to the World Championships at Burley. Did being based over here and obviously your experiences at badminton really set you up for a good preparation going into that? Talk us through it, because it was a major, major achievement at a young stage of your career to take a world title.
And I was also, alone when I say that, you know, I had just been married. And so we lived in Chittern and we stabled at Bathampton House with Lord and Lady Hugh Russell. So we had wonderful facilities. And the English friends I made and still have were great support and great help as to where to compete and et cetera, et cetera. All of it being brand new to me, not only brand new, but I was 21 years old or something like that, 22, I think. And so it was wonderful because, again, the whole reason I wanted to be there and go through that experience was to broaden my knowledge and broaden my horizon as to horses, sport, and everything else. And what I learned, the sport that I saw at badminton, the sport that I saw at Burley, was nothing like anything we'd been exposed to here. And that was my dream, was to put as much effort into making the sport become that important and that big over here as well.
And tell us about Irish Cap, the horse that you won those Burley World Championships on.
Well, he came from Ireland, and he was named after a man named Captain Smith, who was my mother-in-law's cousin. And the way he came over is Cappy actually had bought quite a nice jumper from a farmer in Cork. And the farmer said, you have to take this other horse with it. And the other horse was Irish Cap, who had not been touched. And he was 4 or 5 years old and literally never been touched. He had no halter, nothing. And so it took 2 days to get him. And when he got here, he was difficult to sell because he was, you know, scared of people. And he was a great big horse. And I just loved him. And so my grandmother bought him for me. And I spent a lot of time getting him trained and tamed. But he was a marvelous, marvelous, marvelous horse. And he made my life, didn't he?
And compare his... Mike Tango, I believe, was a very different sort of horse. Talk about him. What were their differences?
Well, Mike, they were both 17-1 and a half. One was a straight thoroughbred, the other wasn't. Mike Tango had been run on the half-mile track as a two-year-old, and so he'd been buzzed up, and his brain had been tested quite a lot as a baby, and so he was nowhere near as steady. Irish Cap was just untouched when I got him. He was older and powerful, but untouched. And once he became domesticated, he became very, very, very dependable and very steady. And Tango was always a little bit fractious. And Tango had an issue. He was a non-sweater. And that was probably the thing that shut his career down more than anything else.
Really?
Yeah.
What is, just to explain for anybody that doesn't know, what, I mean, non-sweater, what implications does that have?
I mean, we didn't know that until the World Championships in 78, but it means that for some reason, when the horse is exercising and even under stress, the body doesn't excrete perspiration. And so that is nature's way of letting out the poison in the system, right? And it doesn't do that. And so getting them to cool down is difficult, and it puts a lot of stress on their system. So for that reason, I retired him quite early.
He made a really big step up, didn't he, though, when he went in 1978 to give you your second World Championship?
He was just a seven-year-old, and in June of that year, he won our preliminary, our one-star championships. That was his first year of eventing. And then in the autumn, in September, he won the Worlds. And
wow.
Yeah.
That is a remarkable,
It was a lot for a seven-year-old. But, you know, also, it's like knowing when a horse is ready to run a race, and time isn't going to make it better. He was game, he was sound, he was brave, he was athletic, he was unconventional, and that was going to remain his style. And I knew him well, and we got along. And so it worked out on that occasion, didn't it?
And the 1978 Worlds were in Kentucky because you'd won the previous one, is that right?
Back in 74 and the ones prior to that, the rule always was that the next country to host the World Championships would be that of the individual winner. And so, for instance, Mary Gordon Watson won it in Punchestown 4 years before Burley. Hence, it came to Burley.
Yeah.
Follow me? And and then I won it in Burley, hence it came to Kentucky.
And then you won it again.
And then I won it again, and then they didn't want. And then I think, didn't they open up where they tried to have the world, everybody together?
Oh, yeah, then we would have had, yes, okay, yeah.
Right, so then the system changed because they didn't, you know, the same country couldn't have it twice.
And the legacy of that 1978 World Championships is the Kentucky three-day event, isn't it?
Correct. Yes, ma'am. Kentucky Horse Park was founded so that the United States could host the World Championships in 1978, yes.
And actually, Kentucky itself has been, since then, an exceptionally happy hunting ground for you. You've won it there six times, which is more than any other rider. How special is it to have that on home soil and the sort of legacy it's left in your career as well?
Well, it's wonderful. You know, as I say, when I was starting out in my early 20s, you know, people didn't think that the equestrian life was, you know, like a way of life, and riding, wanting to ride more than one horse, people thought I was just being ridiculous. And to get the horse park started and to have it be as wonderful and such a fixture in our calendar, I think it's done a whole lot for the sport here, not only in this country, but for the sport in general. I mean, the five-star has started to spread out beyond just Burley and Badminton. And Kentucky was the first one to do that, wasn't it? So
yeah.
I think, you know, it's wonderful. That's what I wanted to do is help the sport grow and become become more than it ever was.
Bruce, the other massive thing that you were the first US rider to do was win badminton, of course. Tell us, I mean, did that mean a lot? And tell us about Eagle Lion as well, because he must have been a hell of a horse.
Oh, my goodness. And isn't the sport made for what he was? I mean, he never had a rail down. He was always in the time. He always finished on his best. He did 14 4-stars, which would be 5-stars in his life. He was an amazing horse. He was a real cheeky bugger and had lots of tricks, but I adored him. And there was nothing like him. He wrote the book on how to jump. And you could jump anything, and he had his own set of eyes, and as you got together, he'd listen to you, and he was a real, real, real joy. But I'm afraid I felt that about all of them.
And that badminton win, do you remember your cross-country ride?
It was wonderful, other than I tripped up the steps coming out of the water and could have ruined the whole thing, but my horse carried me out of it, and other than that, he was foot perfect, and I apologize to him. There's only one place I tried to help him, and I messed him up. But he was third after the dress, and I don't know if I should actually say this, but it was quite a wonderful experience. I met a woman named Lavender through Mary Bromley. I don't know if you all know who Mary Bromley was, but if you look her up, she was fairly influential. And Lavender was somebody who she put horses on the black box and had a lot of races and so forth on it. And she had Eagle Lion on it for badminton that year. And I went and met her and had a very interesting experience with it all. And so, yeah, there was a whole lot more to just being lucky enough to win badminton. It was a real fun year. And he met lots of interesting people.
It's the black box, that's radionics, isn't it? And lots of,
yes.
You find lots of old-fashioned horse people, horse men and women, who would have a real belief in that.
There were a lot of very, very, very fancy racehorses on that box.
I wonder what it was. And thinking of racehorses, you rode quite a lot of ex-race horses, didn't you?
I did. I won
Tango,
the amateur race at Cheltenham, yeah.
You did?
I did. I won the amateur race at Cheltenham, yeah. Henrietta Knight trained my horse, Dashing Fred.
Really? I didn't know that. How fascinating. Was that fun? That must have been amazing fun.
Oh, it's absolutely wonderful, yes. And I've ridden in the Maryland Hunt Cup, and I've done lots and lots of point-to-point. I wanted to ride in the English Grand National, and that was the horse on Dashing Fred that I bought for that reason. But he had a leg injury. He came home to rest, and then we put him back in work, and he was in a race here, and he got injured again, and we had to put him down. That was my Grand National effort. He was my horse that I hoped I would ride the National. But I did get to win the amateur race at Cheltenham, and that was a huge point in my life, yeah.
Was that what sort of year was that, Bruce? Was that in the sort of the heights of when you were eventing at very top level as well?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was all the same. Yeah, I had the horse with Henrietta for a couple of years, point to point as well.
Were you ever tempted to go away and give racing a full-time go?
Well, I trained the Maryland Hunt Cup winner, and I won the little My Lady's Manor and what we call the Little Grand National. And I still have a trainer's license. Yes, I was tempted, and Carol and I discussed the option of possibly staying and living in England. And if I had done that, I think probably I would have been involved in the racing a lot more. I loved it, and my experience was wonderful. And in '74, when we lived in Chittern and kept our horses at Bathampton, we lived and shared one of those cottages that was for two families, and Christopher Bartle was in the other half.
Oh, really?
And he was having his gap year, and his dad had given him two point-to-pointers. Ian Dudgeon was the trainer, and we lived in the other half of the cottage, and we rode out with Ian every morning before we went over to Bathampton House and did our event horse. And oh yeah, I've always loved the racing, and I've done a lot of point to point here.
And it's interesting. I find it fascinating that I knew that Christopher Bartle rode in point to points as well. That the real horsemen and women aren't just confined to one discipline. Would you agree with that?
I have the world of respect for Chris Bartle, and for me, I wanted to know horses. I didn't want to just know one aspect of them. I want to know horses. I want to know. I don't care if you're very good at what you do with horses, then I'm interested in knowing more from you. And whether you ride English Western, whether you race or whether you jump or whether you do dressage or endurance, there's something we learn from everybody.
It's quite remarkable, isn't it? And we see a lot of riders nowadays actually sort of splitting their time between pure show jumping and eventing, or competing in pure dressage and eventing, and kind of doing those two disciplines, but less so in the sort of the racing side of things, which I think is really, really interesting. Bruce, can I ask you?
I think it's interesting from the eventing point of view, because I think possibly one of the issues as far as safety is knowing how to gallop a horse and what kind of a bridle you need to wear to go cross country and have to be safe in. And by safe in, I mean the horse not be afraid to jump because the bridle is too much. And I don't think the younger generation spends as much time learning how to gallop a horse and learning how to relax the horse at the gallop. And learning how to compete the horse in a relaxed fashion. I think it's very hyper.
If I could ask you one, your top tip to anybody listening to this that thinks, actually, I would like to improve my feel for that, what would you advise them to do?
To pick my top what now?
Pick your piece of advice that if somebody listening to this show thinks, actually, I really understand where Bruce is coming from. I want to be able to improve my feel of riding cross country and making sure that I'm prepared.
That's very simple, especially in England. What a great opportunity. I mean, that's just what we did, is go ride out for somebody in the mornings. You know, do two or three sets of racehorses and get comfortable holding a horse and holding it in line and going at the speed you're told to go at and realize that the speed we're going at isn't really all that fast. But also, I think then learning how to school, because part of the issue now is the way the courses are laid out. You have so many areas where you circle and half circle and have to slow down so much that you have to go very, very fast at some of the straightforward fences in between. And there's not as much rhythm as there used to be. And so I think then horses are being rushed over fences and people don't have that experience and the horses don't have that experience. And perhaps that's part of a safety factor that we need to consider. And so for me, I think if all the younger event riders would do a little bit of work in a racing stable and just learn how to get themselves balanced, shorten their stirrups. If you watch a lot of the young people going cross country, they ride on very long stirrups. Most of them are the ones that don't have any galloping experience.
Okay. I think that's good advice, listeners.
And I think it's very interesting because I think that if you looked at some of the cross country riders that we generally respect the most, a lot of them would have had some experience of riding racehorses.
Yeah.
Oh, for sure. Blythe Tate, Mark Todd, Andrew, all of them have galloped racehorses and trained racehorses and have that involvement. Never mind, I mean, anybody from my generation, almost all of us did it to some degree.
I think it's a really valid piece of advice that actually is a fairly easy one to implement. So listeners, there you go. That is something that you can look to do to sort of help improve your cross-country riding, improve your feel, if that you feel you would benefit from it. So absolutely.
It will also just plain improve your condition. And that's so important anyway in our sport.
Bruce, can I bring you back to your championship experiences? You rode in 5 Olympics and 5 World Championships. Of your Olympics, which games hold the happiest memories for you?
Well, I think you make there's so many emotions in all of those things, and that's probably why I guess in history everyone has written about Olympic games, whether you win medals or you don't, but particularly if you do, and how disturbing it can be in life, because I think there's such an effort and you are so self-absorbed in that effort to have the success. So I don't know. I think probably my very first, Munich, we won the team silver and I was fourth individually. And that, you know, I was a kid. But that opened my eyes as to how much more there was. And I would think that was, you know, it was also a big Olympics in the tragedy that happened. And also it was a huge Olympics in the facilities that we were given. They were exceptional. And so I had that to compare every other one to.
Yes. And then, I mean, LA on home turf must have been, well, almost home turf, opposite outside the country, but at least in the US, that must have been pretty special. Yeah.
Very special, and to win gold again, yes, that was all very special. Each one is special. Even when we were unsuccessful, it wasn't that we didn't try. And sometimes it just doesn't go that way, does it?
No.
If you had to pick one highlight of your career, looking back now, what is it that you're most proud of? Is it the Olympic golds? Is it the World Championships, winning badminton? What stands out for you?
I think probably my win with Irish Cap at Burley. He was, you know, an amazing horse. And he and I had been through lots. And he meant lots to me in many, many ways. And he did everything all weekend long as exactly as he was asked and as he executed everything as good as he possibly could. And so I think as a very young person who was naive as to all the repercussions of it, as time has gone by, that was probably the biggest moment in my career.
And Bruce, tell us about your life now, because you still compete, don't you? And you train people and horses. What does your life now involve?
Well, I have about 14 horses in work, very nice horses, and most of them I've bred, and we run a farm, and I train horses, and I help as many people as I can, and I compete, and I don't compete necessarily at a high level, not because I don't want to, but because most of the horses get sold before they go much over intermediate. But I'm lucky. I'm still very comfortable riding, and I break in the young horses myself. And my son doesn't want me doing that anymore, but I like doing it.
I think he's probably just trying to get his hands on a few of your future superstars, Bruce.
Well, no, that's one of the sad points in my life. I mean, Buck doesn't like his father's homebred horses. He likes to pick out his own. And, of course, especially now at my stage, the one thing I want is my own son helping me out riding my horses. But he says I'm the hardest person in the world to ride for.
Do you think he's right?
That's a compliment. I think he means that as a compliment, but it's quite fun because my lot of young horses are getting old enough that they're competing quite a lot more, and I'm just going to make them nice enough that he has to want them.
Yes, make it so he can't resist.
Exactly.
Bruce, if you were competing at sort of five-star championship Olympic level today, and you could have your pick of any horse in the world, who would you most like to steal for your stable?
Any horse that's going right now?
Any horse that's going right now.
I don't know. I suppose I'd either go through Piggy's stable or Pippa's stable. And
you could have a pretty good pick from either of those yards, Piggy French and Pippa Funnel. I mean, there'd be a selection for you.
Exactly.
Yeah, a bit of choice.
A good, well, yeah. And you know, I'd have to sit on a few to pick, but any one of them I wouldn't say no to.
No, I don't blame you. Bruce, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show and to bring you into the Echo Ratings Hall of Fame. You have had such a remarkable career and we have loved learning more about it. I mean, 14 medals at Worlds and Olympics. And of course, you've been to Pan American Games. You've won team and individual medals at Pan American Games as well. It is really quite a remarkable story. So thank you for coming on the show.
You're very, very kind indeed.
Well, we are absolutely delighted to have you on. Bruce Davidson, next in the Echo Ratings Hall of Fame. We hope you've enjoyed this episode, listeners. There are a few more to come from, but rest assured, it is these people that have paved the way for our sport as it is today. And it is a real pleasure to bring them on and hear more about them. Bruce, thank you. Catherine, thank you. We'll be back very soon with another episode of the Echo Ratings Eventing Podcast.
Thank you for listening to the Echo Ratings Eventing Podcast. This podcast is available for free on iTunes, Spotify, Podcast Addict, or wherever you usually listen to your podcasts. Make sure you subscribe so that you don't miss an episode. Find us at eventingpodcast.com or search Eventing Podcast on social media.